The Muskie Shop Medical Center recently concluded a 30-day voluntary trial based on the psychological effects of removing the Muskie 360 podcast from the weekly routines of several test subjects. Here are the startling results.
My name is John. After my 30-day trial without the podcast, I felt depressed. My teeth started to hurt, and I became hesitant when fishing.
My name is Elmer. I thought that not having to listen to Steve for a month would be a good thing. But it turns out I was wrong. I suffered from a loss of appetite, blurred vision, and I no longer wanted patrol.
My name is Freddie Mercury Outboard Palermo. After completing the trial, I no longer wanted to sing. The thrill was gone. The only thing I fished for was crappies, and my shoes fell off. Now I'm back on my feet, and the feeling is strong. I love the Muskie 360 podcast.
The warning signs for side effects from a sudden discontinuation of the Muskie 360 podcast may include nausea, diarrhea, blurred vision, lack of confidence, vertigo, inability to choose correct presentations, poor netting of fish, depression, constipation, dry mouth, insomnia, constant need for Pepsi, heart palpitations, itching, blood clots, inability to read lake maps, nosebleeds,
and in some cases, the Muskie 360 podcast. Jay, side effects may include
Creaker disease.
100%.
I mean, have you ever had that?
When I was a young child, I was diagnosed with Creaker.
It's bad, man. You can't get out of bed for weeks. I mean, it just runs you down.
Well,
if
you're a Creaker, you can't get out of bed early. You can get out of bed.
I misunderstood the whole thing.
Yeah,
I gotcha.
You're not getting out of bed early because you've been into the hooch. So they say.
Okay.
You've been hooching it up. So anyway, big update last week talking about the wreck. I want to thank so many people again. Dudes, there's so many good people in the Muskie game and all you guys that listen to the podcast. Thank you so much for all the kind emails. There are too many people to even thank or reply. Jay, the amount of people that volunteered to give me a boat was insanity.
Yeah, I got a lot of response from that, too. There's a lot of people concerned about they weren't sure if you were hurt, you know, because at that point they hadn't listened to the podcast for the full story last week, you know, and they're just like, what happened? You know, how is he?
Mm-hmm.
Big shout out to Jace from South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Big podcast listener. I talked to him. Really nice guy. And we're going to be seeing them next year. I think we might, all of us might go out the boat the day before the Muskie Shop Bash next year.
Nice.
So, but like the day before. So that's Jace. So
very cool.
Looking forward to it. Yeah, it's a cool guy.
Well, it's awesome. All the cool people out there. It makes you feel warm and fuzzy that many people that many people love you.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me they love me. Could you love me? Do you love
Make an
me?
Assessment.
Make an assessment. Anyway, so it's awesome. I really appreciate it. Definitely gives me the warm and fuzzies in a fun way. You guys are all my bros. So the quick update on that. The fine folks at Low Boats are coming through, Jay.
They're pulling a miracle for you. This is a great story.
Steve Paul.
Yep, let it loose.
The Muskie Machine, version 2.0, baby, is on the way.
We can rebuild it. Well, they're actually not rebuilding
it. They can't rebuild
it. It's trash, but they are rebuilding a brand new model for you. They're pushing, like, anybody that's looked for a boat this last year, good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just like everything. There's big shortages for parts and this, that, and the other thing in manufacturing. And they were telling you what? They were telling you spring of 2023 would be the next one.
That was the next one.
Insane.
Hopefully in 3 to 4 weeks. Now, folks, if you've seen it on the show, you've seen it in pictures. The Darth Vader of all musky boats, the black custom low, is dead. Rest in peace, homie.
Yep.
Pour a bottle of liquor out on the road for him.
Steve's dream boat.
Steve's dream boat version 2.0 is coming. So going red, Jay.
Oh, you're going to go red?
So the same boat with some tweaks, by the way. some sweet twigs. Red, bigger engine, as if I even needed it. So, if, you know, 55, that's for children and women, you know. So we're putting a screamer on this thing. It's going to be pretty cool. So there's an upside. There's a silver lining. The Steve Paul Musky Master version 2.0 will be built. Bigger tackle box. Can you believe that, Jay?
Not really.
As if you needed more.
The tackle box in the old one was something else. So, you guys should have seen it at the end of the Wisconsin trip too. Throw them all in there.
Look like a dumpster, but
throw them all in there and close it. So, time to drive home. It was
gonna be rocking.
Yeah. Steve likes to use a lot of baits. He likes to have them on hand when the situation arises. You know, this, that, or the
you
other thing.
Know.
Sometimes you need to switch them all.
So we're gonna have. Keep you guys posted. We're going from like the Darth Vader look to the Imperial Guard. It's going to be black. It's going to be red. It's going to be mean. So I'll keep you guys posted. I'm just eternally grateful. Thank you, everybody. That again, there's so many dudes that sent messages like, if you need to use my boat, because everybody knows this is what I do for a living, and that means the world to me. I will never go without having two boats from now on out, Jay.
In this case, you're going to have three.
Yeah, well, it happens. Oh, what, the freaking SS Minnow?
Yeah, Jay's super, super tiny John boat thing that I gave you.
The 12-footer of Doom. What's funny is, like, Jay and I were talking when I left Wisconsin, like, got to do some creaker stuff. So definitely you guys will see it. I'll tell you this, boys. And there's a dude that came down fish with from Ohio. We're hanging out, and he was the first victim on the new Steve Paul rig, the Bass Tracker.
The interim boat.
The interim boat.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out, and not as a joke, but just because, why not? I didn't want to put electronics on this friggin' thing, right? It came with a gray Lowrance, like X or LX32 fish finder that's about the size of a Game Boy.
Is that the fish finder that has actual cartoon images of the fish?
It looks, little pixels. It's pretty pathetic. Yeah. It's like you're playing Tetris. I'm rocking that, boys, and we're catching fish. I'll just say it. The dude that was on the boat, we were talking. He knows what I'm talking about. We were talking about depth and temp. You don't need all the crap. Now, sometimes all the crap's awesome to have, but you don't got to have it right now. Living proof in the spring, you're going to see me. I'm going to go out in the SS Minnow, the JSE 12-foot special, and do some creaking here very shortly. So, but yes, thank you, everyone. I will keep you updated on Dreamboat 2.0. It's going to be bigger. It's actually going to be meaner. You know, you always say the next one's bigger and badder. This next one is actually bigger and it is badder, which is, I didn't know was possible, Jay. But you thought we were going fast before. It's going to get gnarly, dudes. It's about to be gnarly. I hope gas doesn't go up anymore. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, no kidding.
In that new boat, I'm rolling around, got a kick-ass 50-horsepower 2-stroke, right? I've burnt like a quarter tank of gas in 3 days. Mm. On the other boat, it's like filling up every day because you go everywhere at 45 miles an hour minimally. Right? Mm-hmm. You're... How can you not? You know, I'm not maxing it out. You got to fly around. This thing has really put it in perspective for me of just like schmutzing, you know, which is fine. It's one thing I'll tell you is a positive, man, getting back to basics. And I really have been getting back to basics with this boat. You know, I can't store 5,000 lures. I can't store 5,000 rods. You know, I've got a few little Plano clears on there, and we're still getting it done, and it just boils down to the same things we're always talking about, which is, you know, speed and depth control and saturation casting and being in the right places. If you got good patterning, everything else falls into place. So,
right.
You know, so that's cool. But other than that, gnarly week for me. I've been on the phone with insurance people nonstop, so we're going to do some Q&A. And get this thing rocking. Get this one in the books. Up versus
I'm talking about.
Bill Kelly. Bill says, come to Minocqua. for a long weekend. I want to maximize my chances of getting my son his first muskie. What are your top five lakes in that area you would suggest?
He's coming to Minocqua this fall? Upcoming or next?
Like,
he's talking next
what
year.
Is today's date? He gave me the date. Yeah, he's like
October 7th.
He's getting there today, boys.
Okay.
I'm looking at
him. If he's coming soon, yeah, we're stuck in a very strange weather pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Unusually warm. I mean, this time last year, it was, you know, the lakes were starting to freeze and turn over and all that.
Mm-hmm.
We're nowhere close to turnover. Lake temps went up a little bit. They're in the mid 60s. So, mm-hmm. There's been a lot of people enjoying the late summer, early fall, whatever you want to call it. A lot of people coming in, going out fishing, you know, getting live bait, using suckers, you know, throwing jerk baits, throwing all the regular fall presentations that they've been hearing about for forever and ever. But, the fishing has been okay. The problem is, I think the fish are everywhere.
Yeah,
there is not a shallow, you know, hot migration, you know, like a lot of people are expecting, because the water temps simply aren't sliding down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think until you start getting into the upper 50s, stuff doesn't really, really kick in. So there's still good green weeds. To try to answer that guy's question, if he wants five lakes in the Minocqua area, give me a call at work tomorrow if you want. I guess I don't want to list some real small ones, you know, to put undue pressure on 200-acre lakes. But, you know, there's a few larger lakes like Big St. Germain.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of pressure on that last week. And other St. Germain area lakes, they had a big muskie tournament, the St. Germain Classic, whatever it's called, something like 175 boats. It was a very large field. The big fish came out of Big St. Germain, I heard, but from a lot of anglers that went out there, very green, very algae bloomed due to weeds dying off, and the water was warm and warming up slightly all week. So not hot action. Some other guys went to a lake just south of there, Sand and Dam. They got one. And I was talking to them about suggesting that one. I thought that one might be clear of any kind of algae bloom issues, because a lot of the lakes around here where I live in St. Germain are kind of bloomed up right now. Poor visibility, and the fishing so-so.
Well,
but give us a call tomorrow. And
yeah, that's
there's,
the thing.
There, there's some other ones on the list. You know, there's a few I tend to recommend avoiding right now, just because of the timing. If you are coming up within the next week, the forecast is remaining warm. We're talking 70 degrees every day and not cold at night. So there's not going to be any major changes. So try to stick with the pattern, which is, you know, what Steve was just talking about a few minutes ago. And I think that's simply, you know, trying everything and doing the fan casting, you know, the 1-2-3 kind of routine to find out where the fish are at, because they're getting a few shallow fish and they're certainly getting a lot of fish off the deeper breaks and the, you know, the deep weed edges. And of course that remains key to find the green weeds, because in a lot of cases around here, half of them are gone right now.
Boom. Bill, call the shop. Obviously Jay's got a lot to say on that matter. To go on here and name the lakes, you know, the problem is, Jay, I think, yep. Me and you're thinking a couple of the same ones, but it's just like some of our dudes guide on those things, so you don't want to just put them on blast. So Bill, call up to the muskie shop, ask for Jay Pat Menards.
Pat Menards.
Pat, we got another Pat Menards. I'm reading it. He writes his very offensive spelled thing where he's imagining I'm reading in a southern accent. It's actually pretty damn funny. He said, "Get yourself a bite of what's your personal gator?" You know, yada, yada, yada. He says, on a serious question, I have some pallets to get rid of. Can I bring them directly to the Muskie shop? Yes.
On a serious note, yes.
Call Tom Rudis. He'll take them off your hands. Pennies on the dollar.
The Pallet King's always looking for more pallets.
You got to stay the king, baby. He says, a side question. He said, I've had great success fishing in the rain. When it comes to raining throughout the next day, do the fish do their eating? Like, so if, let's say it's raining on a Monday and it keeps raining on Tuesday. He said, do they eat up on the first day? Are they done? Are they still going to go crazy the following day? You know, where does it sort of fall in this post-frontal stuff? Basically, summarizing all this, when you have a continuing front and it's actually just raining, generally those fish will stay pretty active through that entire thing. But once it's done, they are done, right? So if it's a continual front, a lot of times you're going to just see good activity throughout that entire front, and they're going to feed up, and then you're going to pay the price for 2 or 3 days after. You know, some of the weirdest fishing I ever see is these in-between storms. Like, it's not post-frontal. It's just like rain rolls through, and then rain's going to keep rolling through, and then rain's going to keep rolling through, and you have these lulls in between. Those are usually difficult times. But if you are out in the stuff, in the elements, you can usually expect some action. Usually that first day is going to be better, but the second day can still be pretty good. I mean, they're going to take advantage of it, you know, especially if you're on a forage base where it's a smaller forage base. Maybe on your tulubi and your walleye base stuff, it won't be as good. But, you know, shad or panfish based stuff, perch, you can do pretty solid throughout the entire storm front. Just be ready to pay the price on the back end. Is generally going to be the thing. Luke says, what are some tips for fishing in October? Also, any knowledge on pre-turnover, post-turnover? When does that happen? What are the water temps associated with it? And how does it affect targeting muskies? Jay, what do you know about turnovers, Apple and Jerry?
Turnover. Well, yeah, we're a ways from it. Like we were just talking about earlier, we're a ways from that. It's probably going to be a little bit late. The long range forecast is still warm. So, and that puts it well into mid October without any kind of chance of really kind of bringing the temperatures down. Quite bizarre. Like I said, just opposite of last year too. The complete opposite. Everything just crashed hard and fast last year. So, an extended fishing season is always good for us in the northern zone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Until the water temps start sliding down to the, you know, mid 50s and such, you know, you're not going to get into that kind of turnover thing where the lakes are actually doing that. The deeper lakes that do stratify need to turn over.
The deal is this, and it's, you know, we get a lot of questions about October and turnovers and these transitional parts of the year, right? I'll tell you, the key to being successful in the spring, in the fall, in the transitions is versatility and what you're able to do. And I mean, it's what I'm doing every day. Like today, you know, it was a matter of trolling. Everything had pulled off in the edges and there's a lot of suspended stuff. Yesterday, everything was up shallow. You've got to make an assessment of what the conditions are saying and, you know, figure out where the fish are based on patterning, whether it be sing bait fish or moving muskies. And then you got to dial in from there. And that's why people struggle in these times, because if your game is topwater and bucktail and small crankbaits, it might work on Monday, but it ain't going to work on Wednesday. Right? So it is the time, the turnover period, the fall transition, heck, the winter transition as well, because you're going to transition into fall and it'll be stable for a while and then it'll get cold and then it'll be stable for a while and then it'll get warm. And these transitional, these in-between periods, you need to be a well-rounded angler to be continually successful.
One thing I'd look at too is that, you know, like in the northern zone around northern Wisconsin where I'm at, where you have this multitude of different bodies of water. We always talk about the luxury of having that. Most people probably don't in their particular home region for fishing. You know, if the lakes are, say, if the water temps are in the 50s, whatever temperature, because they vary throughout every minute of every day. They're always going up or down, right? If they're in the 50s, you're good if the water is not extremely stirred up and disturbed and stinky looking.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead, fish it. Might be pre-turnover. It might have just finished turning over. Hard to say. But if you pull into that lake and the water temps, not in the 60s or 40s, but it's somewhere in the 50s, you're probably good. I would fish that body of water. It's probably right. Just a good, easy way of clarifying that. You know, if the water temp's in the 40s and the water's, not stirred up, it's probably done turned over. So that would be a different way of approaching of what to do on that particular lake.
Yeah, that's the thing is read that. And like I was just saying, variable conditions demand variance in presentation. If the condition, you've got to be versatile in transitional periods. You know, have your big rubber game down, have your small crank down, be sure you got your downsizing stuff down. Have a trolling game plan, whether you can run one rod or 15 rods. Having that under your belt is going to allow you to be more successful. If you're one dimensional and you're faced with varying conditions, it might be a suffer. You might be out there suffering for days. So you've got to sort of make an assessment based upon each lake. Like Jay just said, Lake A might be in one stage or one form of turnover, or another one might be stable or post turnover. So you got to, if you got the luxury of covering some different bodies of water, get out and find one where the fish are moving. If you're stuck on a singular body of water, dig in, right? Spend the first 2 hours of daylight doing what you're good at, and then you better just start getting good at something else. Just switch it up and dig in. Anyway, wow, that was Tim Ives from the stores beeping me, Jay. Tim from the Muskie Shop. So,
Tim,
the mayor,
they call him.
The mayor, I'll call him back.
I think we might be going fishing on Saturday.
Well, tear him up, baby.
Yeah, me, Tim, and Jim, hopefully.
Tim, Jim. Anyway, Eric says, I have a question about map work. Oh, my God. Hold on. He's asking if I just gave him the FU button. Really?
Say, Tim, but let's get him on the phone.
Get him on here, Jay. Call the mayor.
Let's call the mayor and get him on
Folks,
the phone.
We're going to call the mayor and see what the bite is in Minocqua. Prepare yourself. Bite in Minocqua coming up now. Call him.
What's his phone number? I'll call him.
You don't have his phone number.
No.
Oh, my goodness, Jay. This is not even easy now. It went from, like, really easy to you don't have his phone number. Hold on. Boom. I was about to read it out to you.
Let me see if this. Hello?
Tim.
What's going on?
Tim, why are you calling me? I'm trying to do the podcast.
Well, I'm sorry, buddy.
Where are you at the Black Bear?
No, I'm actually at Church Street Pub.
Uh-oh. So you are live on the podcast, Tim.
Yeah, so, that'll happen.
Well, it happened.
Tim!
Tim, the mayor. Tim, what do you were sending some pictures this week to Jody Michael. Looks like you've been tearing it up. A good segue here. What are you seeing on this post-turn, or is it pre-turnover, post-turnover? Sort of the lakes are in flux.
Pre-turnover. The fish have been really starting to go on the suckers lately.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, and good. They've been tied up in the weeds.
And is this on clear, tannic, a little bit of everything, or are they just...
A little bit of everything. I've been on some clear lakes. I've been on lakes that's got some algae bloom and doing well on both.
Right. So, in basically, is it a matter of just sort of covering all kinds of ground, sort of doing...
Yep. Just picking apart them shallow weeds.
Yeah. And what's left of them?
Some algae blooms. You know, we were throwing some double tens, and that's what got us that nice 47 the other night.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, there you go.
Outstanding.
That's all you need to know. Well, folks, put your hands together for the mayor. I'll talk to you here soon, Tim.
look for him on our show next week. We're airing that episode next week with Tim.
It's big.
Hey, have a good night, guys.
Big rubber. Yep, big,
see you,
big
Tim.
Tim.
Yep,
later, Tim.
Later.
All right, folks. So anyway, that's Tim Ives. He's a guy at the Muskie Shop. A really good dude. Love hanging out with him. And we call him the mayor because if you walk into a place in the Northwoods, everyone knows him.
Yeah, so everybody.
It's hilarious. It's like you walk in and it's like going somewhere with the mayor. But anyway, Eric says, hi, I have a question about map work. You've referenced highways fish use between feeding areas. Can you expand on this concept? Do you have tips for map work that help identify these highway areas? I have a hummingbird helix unit with Lake Master chips. So anyway, here we go. So it is structure fishing. All right. There's a guy named Buck Perry that was brilliant. And before we even had flashers, long before we had hummingbird helixes or we had anything on the boats, Buck Perry started figuring out that fish use contours, right? They use shoreline or river channel or contours in a body of water to make vertical movements up, down, away, and travel. So fish exist in this three-dimensional space. They can go up, down, sideways. They can go any direction. They need a point of reference so that they have some spatial awareness so they can go travel through this body of water. So the break lines and contours of a lake or river are the highways. So what I'm looking for are feeding zones that are exits off of the highway, right? So let's say there's a predominant break in a body of water and a point comes onto it, right? So your point is connected to this transit system in a body of water, right? And so if something looks good and it's connected to break lines, it's connected in the sense of these are major thoroughfares, it's going to be a good spot. If you have a spot that is like this gradually sloping nothingness, and there's nothing structurally dominant near it, it might not be a great area. It might look good on paper. The best thing I can tell you is this, and we need to do another one. I know we've covered some of it in the past, but Jay, just mark it down on the notes here. We will do a structure fishing podcast, maybe even next week. That might be a good one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And delve into it because it gets long in the tooth, but fish use... They undoubtedly use structure and seams and a few other elements to move through their environment, right? They don't travel very often in a haphazard manner, okay? So you go, how does a fish keep coming back to the same spots, right? Year after year. Mm-hmm. How does you know, like a fish in Canada where there's always fish on this spot and it's like completely away from this. There are certain elements in a body of water structurally that lend themselves to being highway systems for fish, migratory routes, spawning routes. So they're not just swimming around like goldfish, right?
Do you think muskies have some kind of muscle memory when it comes to like you said, that spot, this spot in Canada? It looks like there's on paper, maybe even on the locator, it looks like there's 500 spots just like it. But this one's always held a hog, you know, and we go back there every year and see fish.
Granted,
there's subtle stuff you're not seeing on the
stuff.
Locator.
I mean, there's a thing, and we, you know what, next week, let's just do it. I'll be on the water all week, and this will be easy.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
From front to back, we'll talk structure fishing. Jay, hold my feet to the fire. You know, we didn't even do a 100th episode because it's been so crazy, but this will be a really good one. I can tell you, it doesn't answer your question, but it sort of it tips the hat to it and what we can get into. There was a study done where they actually used juvenile bass, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they put them in a white room in a clear fish tank with nothing. It was just all white, right? And the fish ambled around the bowl aimlessly, right? Mm. They would congregate together at times, but they would amble, you know, just finning aimlessly around in this area. They put a black dot under the fish bowl, and they all stayed on it all day long.
Hmm.
Right? They put a couple other dots. They would separate, but one would be on one dot, one would be on another. Right? It is some kind of visual representation in my mind, right, that they have.
They need something. Yeah, they need something to relate to.
Right. And, you know, it's goofy and I'm a dork and I own it. But, you know, you look at, like, even in Star Trek, right? So here's a Star Trek thing. How is it the ships are always meeting on this linear plane? You never notice that?
It's like, I know.
Right.
I was thinking about that a minute ago when you started talking about.
Right. So, in sci-fi movies, Star Wars, Star Trek, everything, you ever know?
There's always a flat plane. There's Well, in Star Trek, too, the Wrath of Khan. Remember when Kirk took it, like, you know, 10,000 kilometers above him, and then that was like the only instance I can think of where it's just like, okay, talk 3D here, because space is up, down, and it's not just linear.
And so we always think on this linear plane because we live on a linear plane, because I always tell people, I said, if I jumped on this boat right now and I hovered, you would freak out, right? A muskie can hover in his environment. He just goes up 4 feet and sits. He floats.
Mm-hmm.
Right? How in good God's name does he know how to get back to where he needs to be? You know, a lot of fish, if you look at stockfish will go and try to spawn where they were released. Right? Fish have some kind of memory in some regard. You know, you look at a salmon trying to run upstream no matter what. They have awareness, whether it be cardinal direction. I don't know. And nobody has a true answer on this stuff. But
I don't think so.
They have, you know, they know north and south. They know what's upstream, what's downstream based on the current. And these fish are able to congregate. How do muskies find each other to spawn? Think about that one, Batman. Right? So they all head up north and they head to the north end of the lake or upstream or whatever, and they just bump into each other. No, they know where to go. Party's over here, boys. See you there, right? So to get somewhere, you have to have a map. You have to have a reference point, right? So they know, all of these fish know how to get to the same place. They're following a highway. They're following a direction. They're following a map. They're not just bumping into each other haphazard and going, "Hey, Larry, want to spawn?" Apply a little logic to it, and you go, "Okay, so these fish are arriving at the same destination at predetermined times. How do they all get to the same place? They're using highways. They're using roadways. They're using points in their ecosystem and their environment as a reference." So structure fishing sort of is systemic of this, where you go, there are different elements, points, bars, saddles, trough, trenches, ditches, sloughs, you know, all these different things, break lines, hard break, soft bottom, hard bottom, that fish know to clue in on, so they have a clue where they are in their environment, right? And so we need to just do a whole show on it, and it's time to do it anyway. But, you know, you look at, like, how the heck do muskies know where to find walleye? Muskies know what walleye like. I don't think muskies just swim around all day long looking for walleye. They go, "This looks right." Maybe they don't know and they don't look and they go, "Huh, that's right." They just know it's right through instinct.
Mm-hmm.
But they're using contextual clues and their environment to find things that are appropriate, that are probably genetically predisposed in their little peanut brain to say, "This is where you need to be." Right. And with that being said, if you understand the code, you understand how to read the map. And I'm not saying the fish finder map. I'm saying the map of what is structurally integral. It is far easier to ascertain what is productive water versus what is dead water. Right? So we can get into that. Obviously, you can tell this is a long-winded subject, Jay, is what it is. We'll get into that next week. I would love to do that. So hold on, Eric. I don't have a great singular 5-minute answer for any of that, so we'll get there. Dan, do you have a video on how to do a no BS system? No, but Joe Booker has about 4,000 of them. It's super easy. All you need is a split ring pliers and a big split ring, right? So you can literally cut a swivel off of a leader, or you could cut the snap. You could get, say, a Musky Shop straight wire, right? Cut the clip off of it, take the line snap off there, and put a big split ring, and now you got an OBS.
Yeah, you don't even have to cut them anymore. I mean,
yeah, they pull those, them off. Yeah,
yeah, they just once they're open up, you can just back them off on those stringy style. So
all the no BS,
easy to replace.
Yeah, all the no BS system is replacing your snap with a split ring. That's it. So if you take the snap off, use a split ring instead to attach your leaders, you've got a no BS system. Alan, just got back into musky fishing this year. We missed you. Welcome back. Obviously had to buy lots of baits. My question is about bucktails. I watched lots of videos of people fishing. A lot of people love these 8-9 stagger blades. I feel it might be a great for high pressure clear water, but I'm fishing dirty water in Ottawa. Very dirty water. What kinds of bucktails would be best for these stained waters? I don't think that the stagger blade is going to make a difference. If you went through a staggered and dirty water, it might not hurt, right? I don't think really like the blade combo is going to matter too much on that stained water as long as you got a big thump. You gotta allow them to call them in. So try an 8-9 stagger. Try double 10s. You know, unless you're on insanely pressured water where there's a ton of people, you know, any combo will work. If you're dealing with stained water, I'm not worried about the combination. I'm worried about the lure color that's going to be most productive in that clarity. Right? So I'm not going to go and throw copper blades and brown in muddy water. Right? So consider,
yeah,
right, consider your
it boils down a lot to, yeah, I mean, any, yeah, bucktail is going to work. All bucktails make a with the exception of some really small ones that, mm-hmm, have tiny blades. For the most part, all bucktails are putting out quite a bit of vibration. They will find it. Uh-huh. They're if the water's dirty, they're in tune with that.
I mean, yeah,
they not a problem. They're hearing and feeling and able to home in on pretty much any bucktail presentation. So it's a matter of, I think it's you were just starting to get to before I cut you off there, you know, uh-huh, get down to, the color selection and the size, you, yeah, know.
And it, not even blade size profile. You know, I've caught a lot of fish, I'm just sort of cut them down myself where it's a single skirt double 10. So here's a short little bucktail with double 10s. Well, it's a small target with big thumb. So make sure your bucktail, the size of your bucktail, the skirt, the body area is appropriate for whatever you need to be fishing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the joys of making your own bucktails. You can get parts and pieces from the shop and make whatever your little wormy brain can think of. But sometimes, you know, double 10s and on a 6-inch bucktail are cool. Or sometimes you need a Shumway freaking giant flasher. So size, profile, right?
Yeah, profiles are very, very important in bucktails.
More so than I think than the blade combo.
Yeah, I mean, you guys had that day earlier this year. I think you were out with the other Tim, mm-hmm, your buddy Tim from Kansas, where he lives?
Kansas slash the Netherlands,
yeah, right? And you guys had that day where you're like, we couldn't downsize enough. Uh-huh. I'm assuming it was a high pressure post frontal thing. Mm-hmm. And you started trimming. What were you trimming? Like little naps or something like that?
That was me and Pete Mena.
Oh,
that was me and Pete. We started with.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I was taking scissors and cutting skirts in half on the boat, and then, mm-hmm, it started working. Mm-hmm. It's like they were coming in. Like if you threw anything other than like a 6-7 blade, they wouldn't come in, but it was like they wouldn't hit them. You go, oh, crap. Okay, we got the right, mm-hmm, vibration. Now we need to get the right profile. So for me, it's not the blade combo. It's the right vibration, which might be a stagger blade combo. It might not be, but that combination with the right color and profile. So it's always going to come down to vibration, profile, and color being the least, in my opinion. But dialing in on that's far more important. But like you said that day, I mean, here's me and Pete Main, and we're cutting things up and tearing things up, and then we found something that worked like gangbusters. Boom, boom, yeah, boom. Game, cool. Game on like Donkey Kong. All right, Mike Dietermann. Mike Dietermann from Germany. Mike, when fall fishing with a sucker, I've always attached my quick strike rig to my leader and have had success catching fish. Is what I'm doing common or should be tying directly to the rig? I'm running 80-pound braid. Also, if I tie to the rig, what's the best knot to tie? I have no problem with what he's doing. He's just putting a quick strike on the end of the leader.
That's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Nothing wrong. I do that. If I'm being lazy, I'm like, you know. I don't think there's an issue with that as long as you've got a good quality leader on there. Just clip a quick strike on there. If it's an extra casting rod, be done with it. No problem there. Mark.
Yeah, you're.
Mark says. Oh, he's talking about last week. We actually had this one snuck in there about people want to know on the deep dive, but he's wanted an in-depth winter video for tubes and some big rubber. We can definitely do that, man. Especially showing Jim's way of rigging tubes. The way Jim rigs tubes is the way I rig them for him, which is in the video. So
go to that's the on the app.
Yeah, go to the Muskie 360 app. There is a video of me rigging tubes. I'm teasing. Jim knows how to rig them, but I do them really fast. If you go on the front page, it's on there, re-rigging Red October tubes. That's how they are done.
Plus, you can see Jim actually catching a bass in the background while you were
Which is hilarious.
It is funny.
It is. It's like
he's trying to shake off that largemouth. That was funny.
Also, he said some advanced jerk bait videos on tuning. By the time that's coming out, buddy, we're going to be to a jerk bait you don't have to tune. I'm talking about the Titan. Robert, good morning. Hope you can help. When trolling a super shad wrap with boards, I see most guys run a 2-ounce snap weight above the bait. What's the dive curve when doing this, or how does adding weight change crankbaits? I can't tell you exactly because speed is going to be a factor there, right? So if you add 2 ounces of weight to something, you're going slow, going fast, it's going to change that. Anytime you add this weight to these crankbaits or anything, you've got to figure out your own trolling chart, if you will, right?
Yeah, because so, when that increases the depth at a shorter intervals, as you get more in line out, by adding weight like that, I think. So it's going to be tough to pin.
And the thing is this, I'll tell you, and the reason I sort of smacked this question in there was to cover the topic of augmenting a bait or changing speed. So if you look at the app and you look at a trolling depth chart for, say, a matlock, right, 10-inch matlock, you're going to get the different settings, and they're going to be, I think we're set at like 3.5 or 4.5 on that. These are rough parameters, okay? The way you truly figure out how deep a bait is running is knowing where you're fishing, right? So let's say I want to hit 7 feet deep with a tough shad, right, Jay? If I want to hit 7 feet deep at 3.5, I make sure I drive over a spot that I know is free of debris and free of snags that is 7 feet deep at 3.5 on my boat with the rods I'm using, with the rod holders angled the way I fish them, and I hit it and I go, that was 18 feet of line. Right.
So a little homework involved.
A little homework. And I'm telling you guys, you want to get into ninja tricks on trolling. Everybody's wanting like, how deep does this run in this? How deep does this run in that? Current in reservoirs and rivers changes dive curves, addition of weight, different leaders. I've always sort of thought that you look at a suffix, right? Which is smooth feeling. Versus Joe Booker's Beast Braid, which feels rough in my fingers, right? You rub your hand down Suffix, it feels smooth. Beast Braid feels rough. That stuff's going to have more water resistance than Suffix, right? Power Pro feels coarse. So different brands of 80-pound braid. If you are into precision trolling, you need to become a diligent tester of running depth. So trolling charts from all these companies or from the app are all very rough parameters. Okay. They're going to get you in the ballpark, but they're not going to get you exactly there because wind, waves, water, a lot of things come into play there. So if you know you're dialed in, you go, Muskies are holding at 10 feet deep. I've caught 4 of them this week, and that is exactly where I need to be. I need to be hitting 10-foot breaks, and I need to be digging, ticking, and clicking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you need to be playing, and you need to have one rod out, and you go, I'm going to take a Cisco Kid, and I'm going to drive past at 3.7, a spot I know to be 10 feet deep, and I'm going to drive over it, and I'm going to see if it hits. And if it doesn't hit, then I'm going to drive over it again with a little bit more line. And I'm going to go, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to go, and I go, okay, it's 17 feet is what I need to have out. Now, you know, with that particular Cisco Kid, with the line you're running, the speed you're running at with consistency, you can hit that depth. So you've got to be scientific in your approach if you're looking for dialed-in trolling tactics, right? So guys that are adding like 2 ounces of lead to a shad wrap, there's a reason for that. They're dialed in on a certain depth range, right? So you've got to ascertain what's that bait doing, where are we going to run that at, what's our intended running depth, and how we're going to replicate it. Trolling charts are a rough parameter for you to get started. You've got to become a trolling chart master. You've got to sort of come up with your own trolling charts where you go, hey, if I run, I'm running 55-pound Power Pro instead of 80-pound, it's going to change the world, right? So be a researcher. Research, spend time on the water. If you're a big troller or you're getting into trolling, a lot of hour and go somewhere where you go, there's no stumps, there's no wood here, there's no real bad rocks. I can let out line until that thing's banging the bottom and I understand that it, you know, 22 yeah. feet with a reef digger, it hits bottom.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. Okay. And then you just make notes. Make notes in your phone. Make notes on a little pad and paper, and you can sort of dial in from there. I mean, that's what it's crucial to be a good troller and start accumulating and amassing your notes. The other thing I'll say is this, an aside. When we get into serious trolling, that's why I have trolling baits and casting baits, right? Because I got certain Jakes, and I'm like, this Jake runs at this, and I will take a Sharpie, and I will write it on the back of the bait.
Mm-hmm.
Right? 45 feet, 3.6. Caught a fish. You see what I'm saying? So yeah. I'll mark on that bait what it's good at. Okay, it hits 12 real easy at 60. So sort of lotting trolling baits, casting baits, and dialing in this herd of specialized trolling baits where you go, this guy was awesome at, you know, I've got one reef digger from Big Fork, dude, where it's just like, that thing can hit the bottom with no, it's like it could have 10 feet of line out and that thing's going to dig at 30 feet. It's like, that's mm-hmm. it's just a plow, you know? Yeah, I've got different headlocks and, you know, you got your matlocks now that run at slower speeds, but I've got some headlocks, 2 of them actually that run ridiculously well at 3 miles an hour. Right? Here's this big 12-inch bait just swapping back and forth. And I know at, you know, 27 feet, they're going to run great at certain parameters. So keeping notes, and I always tell you this, don't make mental notes on trolling baits. Just have a log and keep it in your cell phone. Make a little notepad of how these baits are running and how you're going to implement them.
Yeah, good idea.
You know, it's just super solid across the board to really just be diligent on that front. But anyway, Jay, we've caught up on Q&A a little bit, folks. I know I missed some questions after the big wreck there and all the ridiculousness. It's a crazy week for me. I've been on the phone with insurance companies all week long. I've got to get up at the crack of dawn tomorrow. So next week, Jay, you're going to hold my feet to the fire, right?
Yeah, we're talking structure. Possibly master. Yeah, structure.
Oh,
fishing.
It's a master class. It's going to be
boring,
but boring yet informative. So, folks, I'm going to sign off here. Say goodnight, Jay.
Later.
Later, dudes.
The Muskie Shop Medical Center recently concluded a 30-day voluntary trial based on the psychological effects of removing the Muskie 360 podcast from the weekly routines of several test subjects. Here are the startling results.
My name is John. After my 30-day trial without the podcast, I felt depressed. My teeth started to hurt, and I became hesitant when fishing.
My name is Elmer. I thought that not having to listen to Steve for a month would be a good thing. But it turns out I was wrong. I suffered from a loss of appetite, blurred vision, and I no longer wanted patrol.
My name is Freddie Mercury Outboard Palermo. After completing the trial, I no longer wanted to sing. The thrill was gone. The only thing I fished for was crappies, and my shoes fell off. Now I'm back on my feet, and the feeling is strong. I love the Muskie 360 podcast.
The warning signs for side effects from a sudden discontinuation of the Muskie 360 podcast may include nausea, diarrhea, blurred vision, lack of confidence, vertigo, inability to choose correct presentations, poor netting of fish, depression, constipation, dry mouth, insomnia, constant need for Pepsi, heart palpitations, itching, blood clots, inability to read lake maps, nosebleeds, and in some cases, creaker disease.